you've made something that people will like, you know.
And Stephanie is the co-hostess with the mostest.
Relax there, Chris.
Yeah, okay. Second Sight NYC is the show that even the spirits listen to.
How can you make such a claim?
Well, the spirits told me. Give us 2 hours to open your minds to the possibilities of what could be.
This show is all about what is seen and unseen, known and unknown, and everything in between.
Each week, we make the unbelievable believable.
Join us.
Light up your night with The Kevin Smith Show. Hi, this is Kevin Smith. Join me Monday through Friday right here on the Paranormal Network.
Welcome to another episode of The Dawn of Shades. I'm your host, Gia Scott, and today is May 22nd, 2012. We're continuing our Native American Voices series with another program, another story, and another point of view tonight in our seventh program of the series. Now, before we get started, let's start off with some information and reminders. Our website is still under repair, so cross your fingers for that job to get completed soon. We're also still collecting recipes for our cookbook project, so you can email them to me at gscott@exogenynetwork.com. We're hoping that everybody contributes to truly reflect the world we live in and cook in today. So, don't wait. Go ahead and do that. Now, if you're like many people, balancing environmental causes and the reality of your budget is an act worthy of a tightrope. If you kick your handy-dandy search engine and type in Obama's war on coal, Fox has an interesting article indicating that we can anticipate increases over 2,000% on our electric bill. Now, for those who are as math-impaired as I am, I did recruit my husband to do the calculations for me so we could compare what a bill that costs $250 today with what a 2015 electric bill of equivalent size would cost. The figure he gave me just about caused a stroke. That $250 bill today would be $5,577.50. So, if you've been considering self-sufficiency, going off-grid, and other more environmentally friendly solutions than using electricity, now might be the time. Now, since I'm in the same situation, I think we can safely say we can anticipate some programs in the future focusing on how to keep those bills down. Now, for tonight's program, just like all programs, I would love to have the audience's input with questions and comments. If you have joined the virtual auditorium in Pal Talk, you can send them to me via text, or if you're listening through one of the other venues, you can email them to me at gscott@exogenynetwork.com. This is true even if you're listening in on a rebroadcast or podcast of the program. So please, if you enjoyed it, drop me a quick email and tell me so. If you didn't enjoy it, well, drop me an email anyhow and tell me why. And moving right along, tonight we are fortunate enough that we're being joined by David Sam, Greg McVicker, and Cheyenne Beatty, all along with some very interesting topics. I also have the great fortune of having Keith Cicola as my guest co-host for the series. We're going to start off with Keith Cicola, my co-host, introducing himself to the audience. So, Keith, go ahead.
Well, hello, everybody. It's good to be back here. My name is Keith Cicola. I'm Anishinaabe from Northern Minnesota. I currently live, and you're talking to me from Tempe, Arizona. And tonight it's going to be a great subject. We've got three veterans of the Native Radio Network. And personally, I've been looking forward to hear what insights are coming and where we've been. And also the whole social network and the whole new paradigm that Native media is ushering in. So tonight, I'm really a student of this show, and I welcome our guest, David, Greg, and Cheyenne. Miigwech, come on.
So Cheyenne, we'll let ladies go first, so you're next in the hot seat.
Hello, Nijigamonche. My name is Cheyenne Beattie. I am Hongwichin Athabascan from the small Athabascan village of Eagle, Alaska. I'm the host and producer of the national show Earth Songs, which I had actually had the opportunity to learn from Mr. Greg McVicker, who did Earth Songs previously, and he has been my mentor for a very long time, so I'm really glad to be on the show with him and David Sam.
Okay, Greg, you're next. You want to tell us a little bit about yourself?
That was very nice, Cheyenne. Great to be here, and great to hear Keith's voice. Big fan of Keith. I produce Undercurrents, which is a daily music show that was designed to appeal to Native Americans. That's our mission. 5 hours a day, 35 hours a week. Goes out on public radio, so we'll be talking more about that, I guess. I'm Clinkett. My mom is from Haines, Alaska. And I live in the Bay Area and have most of my life, and that's where my studio is. And anybody that knows anything about me will know that any quotes from Fox News, I believe, need to be taken with a grain of salt. So, you know, we heard about the war on nutrition, the war on marriage, the war on Christmas, and now it's the war on coal. I'm going to ask you, Keith, what happens when you have a war on coal and a war on Christmas? Does that affect what you get in your stocking? I'm not quite sure.
Well, David, you're next in the hot seat.
I'm David Sam, and I'm actually from the center of the universe. Greg is a little bit north of me. That's where he was born, I guess. But I'm from Sitka, Alaska. I'm Clinkett, and I work for KMDA Radio, the Native-owned urban station.
Okay, so that's the crew that we've got tonight, folks. So, you know, why don't we start off by telling everybody a little bit about why would Native American radio be different than any other ethnic radio?
Why is it different, you're saying?
Well, can we define
what ethnic radio means? I'm not quite sure.
Ethnic radio would be radio that's not geared for mainstream, that's geared to someone of a particular language or culture.
Mm-hmm. Well,
there's Cajun radio, and there's all these different kinds of radio, and oftentimes part of the broadcasts are in another language other than English.
The tribal aspect, Indian radio stations, in other words, a polite way of maybe saying ethnic radio stations, you know, like what do we mean when we say, what is the difference between a radio and a top 40 radio station in Rapid City?
I think it has a lot to do with the people that are involved within the radio station. First and foremost, I think, as a good example, Kwanic Broadcast Corporation is the only urban Native radio station in the country, and it was formed about 16 years ago. And one of the reasons why it was formed was there was a lot of press going on within the state of Alaska, and most of the press for Alaska Native in general was not good press. And continuously, I think the general public saw the very the worst-case scenario in certain subjects when it came to Alaska Native. But nowhere was there this opportunity or anybody showing the positive things that we do in our Alaska Native cultures. And so that was kind of one of the main reasons why Kwanic Broadcast Corporation was started, and I'm sure why other stations have been started across the United States. It's basically our place that we can use native voice and tell our own stories. I believe that there is a story at one point, and I'm not sure exactly what village it was in, but basically there had been an epidemic there in the early 40s or 50s, and all these people had died of, I believe, like some disease like tuberculosis and such, and they were going to exhume the bodies so that they could research what epidemic had hit this village. And the non-native reporter basically reported this story, but said that the natives were upset because they didn't want the bodies to be exhumed because they were afraid of spirits coming out, and that was their story. But the native reporter said, no, we're afraid that the disease will come out, you know? And they were able to talk about the culture, about the traditions, because they're from that area and they know that. And I think a lot of the times non-native reporters are filling their own blanks with what they think they know about our cultures. And so I think that it's a great opportunity for us all across the country to have radio stations on reservations, so that not only do we have native voice, but we can also perpetuate, preserve, and promote our cultures through language, through culture, and through many different forms of media. So I think that, for me, is why I think it's different.
What about the history of native radio in America and in Canada and in Alaska? If does any Greg or David, do you have any reflections, or Cheyenne, when did it start and how did it start and anything like that to inform our audience? Is pretty new to this subject for most of us.
Well, I know a few little piece parts of it. You guys can chime in with me. But, you know, each native radio station, it comes out of that particular tribe or reservation or wherever they're based. It's a local effort. And they license the station, and over time, I guess they've come to be about 35 or so, and must have been about 20 years ago or so, and you guys could help me with the exact dates. It's probably on Wikipedia. AROS was formed, American Indian Radio on Satellite, to provide programming for these stations that are spread out all over the U.S., you know, the upper and lower 48 states. And AROS did a great job of providing programs like Native Sounds, Native Voices, trying to think of some of the others. But, yeah, so, and there was also this other audience that was not served by radio stations, and that was the budding streaming audience. And I'd have to say, I don't have any numbers to back this up, but just my impressions, having been very close to the streaming industry in the earliest days, I have to say Native people jumped on that as a group faster than anyone else, out of necessity, because there was so little Native media available. And if you could get your hands on a computer, and I think it was Real Audio, you could stream it and listen wherever you were. And so in urban Native audiences as well. So, you know, I forget what they called it, the electronic talking circle, or talking drum, or whatever. I forget exactly what tagline they had, but it was a great way for people of all nations to come together, you know, around the music and, you know, public affairs and so on. And that has carried on now with the subsequent network, sort of under new management, if you will, and that's Aquatic Broadcasting's NV1, which continues providing this kind of service to Native stations and any other stations that want it as well. And there's programs like Earth Songs, which is Cheyenne's show, and help me out, guys, here. What's the Native Health show? That's a great show.
We used to have the Friday Wellness Edition, which was a health show.
Voices mm-hmm. from the Circle, and there's a new hip-hop show. I'll look these up while we're talking. But, and then Undercurrents is on there, and that's we're kind of a filler, you know. I mean, 5 hours a day, and they run that twice. So that's 10 hours a day on the stream and plenty of programming for stations to use if they want to. So, and we serve about a quarter of our stations are native stations, and the other three-fourths are non-native stations that have taken a great interest in the music and sort of the musical point of view, I guess you'd say. And so we're on 107 stations now, but only about 30 of those are native stations. So we're growing. And more of those stations are carrying National Native News and Native America Calling and some of the talk shows as well.
Yeah, well, I know my first exposure to Eros was actually on a mainstream station in Arizona or New Mexico when I was traveling. You know, you flip through the dial looking for something to listen to. And that was the first time, I mean, that was quite a while ago, that I heard Eros. And probably my first exposure to Native American radio. And, you know, I found it interesting. The music was interesting. Now, granted, sometimes there may be language issues, but, you know, we kind of can get around those, I guess. Music speaks to everybody, no matter what language you speak. We all understand music.
Definitely.
Isn't that right, Keith?
Well, it's interesting, too, from a musician's point. Like, a lot of breaking yourself into the business is to having the support of radio behind you. And so, in many ways, a native formula for breaking an artist is to use native radio. I mean, if people ask me, you know, how am I going to move this new album, and that's one of the things I'm going to do is I'm going to utilize this niche marketing that is in place for us and expand on it. But it's some place where we can get into the programming sooner than if we were reaching a mainstream audience. It might take corporate sponsorship, or maybe my record label buys an ad on their radio program or in their radio show. It's kind of the same formula, kind of, but it's a much easier, more flexible programming that native radio seem to have, and it's for our artists. I think that many native artists utilize this service.
Yeah, and it's interesting that the people you have on right now all sort of handle that from a different aspect. Like David does a terrific local show in KNBA and in Anchorage, and I tune into what he's doing just to get, ideas. So he's especially dialed into what's happening with native artists, and so he can really, build things up on the local level. Cheyenne can run with that. She has a local show too, but can run nationally with Earth Songs, which is all contemporary native artists like Keith and so many others. And then I can run with those and take them to a broader audience. Like I said, it's, both native and non-native stations, and weave, the best of the native tracks in with, the best of everything else that's going on, so that it doesn't feel like a niche market anymore. It remains, as much as public radio can be mainstream, it is more of a mainstream audience. And it's like, well, yeah, some artists are black and some are Latino and some are native, whatever. They're all in there together. And I know the artists really always appreciate that, too. And the listeners do, too.
Well, the whole issue of royalty, like if native radio stations or if Indian cars, say, if I got a regular ASCAP royalty every time native stations would be playing, it would be a lot different. I mean, just from that aspect of that relationship, how native radio can play without copyright, or I don't really understand that relationship. Greg or Cheyenne or Dave, maybe you can reflect some light on it.
I just know that, like, if I do streaming, they have regulations upon that now that you can only have 3 songs from one album and 1 song from another album. And Greg could probably elaborate on this much more. He's the techie.
Because I think that gets at the special trust relationship that people need to understand, how native radio, there was a void that native radio filled.
and that void where trust sanctuaries that were created, we call reservations. And I think that gets down at maybe even understanding why certain things get royalties and some don't, or they just don't.
Keith, if I could jump in there, you know, I know there's always a really vibrant discussion around contracts and whether or not, you know, tribes should enter into certain kinds of contracts that are considered standard in the industry. But I don't think anybody would have much of a leg to stand on to say that they don't owe ASCAP and BMI and CSAC royalties. I think everybody is supposed to pay that. Now, small stations, they don't pay much. They pay probably a little flat fee every year, and that's divided up. And Michael Jackson's estate probably gets most of it, you know, because it's just by some, you know, industry average, right? So a little tiny station out in, you know, Tuba City or something plays Indian Car. That station maybe pays, well, let's say they pay $500 cap or something like that. That $500 is going to be divided up among the many tens of thousands of other artists out there by some kind of average. But the good news is on a show like Earth Songs, for example, or Undercurrents, I mean, we need to report what we play to the Sound Exchange, which collects the royalties for anything that's streamed. And about two-thirds of our stations stream. Some of them are pretty big. A lot of streams out there. So every time one of the broadcasts is that includes your song, every time your song is streamed on a broadcast, you know, you get like 0.004 cents or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I've heard it also, and I've seen it, you know, in ASCAP statements. And I've also seen the other aspect of being, at least in the early days where, I don't know, it seemed like there was a lot of pirate radio going on and no one knew about fees to pay, but we're on the air and we're broadcasting and, you know, whatever had to happen, I guess, I don't know.
I think the other thing too that's going on right now as well is that, for instance, I totally wanted to do a billboard chart for Native American music, contemporary music, but not everybody puts up a playlist or submits a playlist, even regardless if they're streaming it or not, they're still not doing that.
Right.
So that
I'm
going to
interrupt you guys real quick
for
a question from the virtual auditorium. And the question is, where can Native American radios be found on the Internet?
NV1.org, Native Voice 1.
Native Voice 1?
Yeah, NV1.org.
And KNVA.org.
Well, there's a lot of them, yeah, KNVA.org. NV1, I think, has a pretty comprehensive listing of all the... I'm right.
Yeah, NV1 basically enables people who don't have access to the reservation or village-based Native-owned operated stations to stay connected. By you can listen to independent radio producers who contribute Native-oriented programs to NV1, and there's quite a list of programs that they have on there. But I'd say that's a very comprehensive place to start.
Yeah, there's a webpage at nv1.org. It's just nv1.org/stations.html. There's a link there, and it shows by state. And each one of these, I don't know if they're linked here. Yeah, some of them are. Some are, some aren't. So and it's pretty easy to go find Station A or WOJB.
And you can always go to earthsongs.net.
Well, Greg and David and Cheyenne, if I'm like an artist and I'm coming to you, I want to promote myself, what would you tell me? How would I go about it? Through Native Radio?
Well, you'd write to Cheyenne at earthsongs.net, and you'd write to me at undercurrentsradio.net, also on Facebook. And say, hey, I got a new record, and...
Do you take it like, would you take MP3s, downloads, or do you like CDs? And I'm just asking questions that like, there might be a young native artist listening there that wants tips.
This is what I do. And actually, I'm spedia@knba.org that you can send my stuff to. But basically, I have an Earth Songs Facebook page, and I consistently put up where you can send CDs. And now I have like a You Send It account. So most people now are sending me a hard copy of their album in the mail. But before I even get that album, they basically go to my URL and they just upload their MP3 songs and they'll send that to me. And Earth Songs has a new format now to where any artist who wants to be interviewed on Earth Songs has to be to record their own answers because of the way things are now. You can easily get on, you know, Cool Edit or GarageBand and record yourself. And then we do what is called like a double ender. You take the, you know, waveform that they give you, and I take mine, and I put it together so it sounds like we're in the same room, even though we're across the country from each other. And so you can always go to earthsongs.net, and it will show you how to send in an album. And basically, a lot of people, if they just go on Facebook, you can find Earth Songs as well. And that's how people have been submitting. But lately, I've definitely had people more so send me MP3 files than actual hard copy albums. I do get those hard copy albums. And David, he also uses the hard copy albums as much as I do. So for his show, Indigenous Expression, he'll use it. Plus, I use it for Earth Song. Plus, we use it for 90.3 KNVA. So an album can go to three different, you know, programs.
And, you know, like I know Native Radio has a lot to do with Native journalism as well. And if you're a journalist coming up or established, you know, how would we pretty much do what the musicians do? You know, copy the same format, get on the stations, write blogs. You know, maybe you have some insights to that aspect of Native journalism on radio.
Well, this is really an exciting to journalism just because of the easier access to the media through blogging. It's an opportunity for someone just getting into it to, you know, get practice every day and get a following and get some valuable feedback. So I would encourage anyone to, you know, start a blog and get some real critical feedback from people, not just your friends, but people that really can help you grow. Of course, there's the formal education route and all of that as well. And I'm a big supporter of that, having gone through that and taught journalism over the years. But, yeah, and then, you know, National Native News, I think they're always looking for, you know, independent stringers to make contributions. More voices coming in from all over Native America, better.
And then there's also the Native American Journalists Association, which, Najah, you can find out more about that, too.
Yeah, just
okay.
One more
and
thing
what
about
the name of that organization again?
It's called Najah, the Native American Journalists Association.
Okay.
It's NAGA, isn't that the acronym?
N-A-J-A.
Did I see? Thank you. I didn't. I wasn't.
I did.
So Keith, you get an F for spelling tonight.
I just did that because they're journalists and I'm a musician.
Well, I know you spell pretty well, so. Yeah, so, you know, and with all these things that are going on, and with the boom in electronic media, do you think that that's making it easier for each small reservation and village to have their own station?
Well,
this is David. I was thinking about Greg's comment about NV1 and taking a look at that. What was it, NV1/Radio, Greg?
No, NV1.org.
.org/stations. That is
slash
there's a link there to stations.
Okay. Yeah, and you know, I think Keith, you were correct. I think there's a lot of flexibility with native-owned stations, and with those stations that are listed, I think at the address that Greg just gave, there's a lot of stations out there, and the reporting is necessary. That's a real key, but there's also community advisory that sort of take a look at the programming for the stations. So the artists do get some residuals, and it's always helpful. But in thinking about Native American artists, American Indian, Alaska Native artists, I don't think there's enough that is put out there. But it seems to be that there's a lot of material that is very regional. People like to, I don't know, I'm just thinking that people like to sort of stay close to home, if you will. But then you have people like yourself, Keith, that are very national, international folks and have been able to put together music that is widely known. But I think a lot of new artists sort of get a feel for their region, whether it's Southwest or Southeast. But it just seems like there's not enough coming nationally. Does that make sense?
I would agree to that, and I think it's, you know, close to understanding our cultures in that. If you understand how much fiddle music means up in Saskatchewan, in Manitoba, and some parts in Ontario and things like that, and what that kind of music is, you're going to see more fiddlers come up in that area. When I can see this almost regionally, too, with tribes. I can tell you there's a lot of Hopi guitar players who play guitar. There's a lot of Chippewa flute players, you know, like things like that, little idiosyncrasies that would indicate regional, environmental, what the music is in their ethnomusicology, what the music has been, what the earth sounds like in their particular areas, I would say. These hierophanies of nature kind of dictate sounds that we hear as well, and so that makes perfect sense to me. And I always try to take the local community where I'm from and bring that into a broader national sound, into the mainstream, into the main current. But I can really see the truth in the, you know, that regional, and what people like to listen to is also determined a lot by the regions that they're in. And then some places, maybe native language is more, maybe that's some of what the contemporary music we're hearing, where like the group of Kashtin, I remember a few years ago in Canada, were very big, and they spoke in their native tongues and things like that. And in them regions, it caught on good, too. But, say, for in the Southwest, it would be kind of difficult because of the linguistical differences and also the environmental indications.
I like that we're talking about this subject because I really wanted to do something similar with Earth Songs. And, you know, fiddle music, which I think people maybe didn't really think, oh, that's not contemporary Native American. But here, I'm Hongwichan Athabaskan. We have an Athabaskan Fiddle Festival every year. So I did a special on Athabaskan fiddling, how it came from the Métis people. And I think it's really great if we did more shows like that and talked about the region and where it's from, like Chicken Scratch, you know, that, for example.
I lived most of my life in Arizona, and to this day, when I hear Chicken Scratch music, it takes me back to being a teenager.
And that area, right?
Right, yeah, because it's really popular, primarily like in central Arizona, I think. Maybe southern, too, but...
Well,
I heard more of it in central Arizona.
Well, the whole story of Chicken Scratch, you know, it really means Walla music, and that whole Walla music came from the influence of German polka kind of fermenting in the desert for years. You know,
because
they came and they left their instruments and their music, and then the Odom people just kind of interpreted it with this Mexican polka, waltz, and all these other forms of. And it's a wonderful event, man. You can see 5,000 people in the streets of Tucson listening to chicken scratch or walla music. So, go ahead, Sean. We kind of interrupted
you,
your train.
You can't help but smile. You know, I guess when you listen to, for me, it's a case. When I hear chicken scratch music, you have to smile. You know, I don't know what it is about it. It's different than
it's happy. But go ahead, and Sean and David and Greg, what about other regional music, like we talked about the fiddle and chicken scratch? Any other parallels that you see here?
Well, Nations Mohawk has produced some great guitarists, like Derek Miller, Robbie Robertson, Jimmy Wolf, just great, great, you know, blazing blues guitar. And I don't know exactly what you'd attribute that to, but...
Maybe because they could walk on high beams
yeah.
or something like that. You know?
Yeah, they're not afraid to take a solo, you know?
Yeah.
Wire
in this area, too, one of the things that, like Bumula is a perfect example, their Yupik world music, and, you know, a lot of kids have now started infusing that Yupik drum and a Nupiak drum with hip-hop beats and their language. And so now I see this blending of music from your culture with, you know, typical genre styles of music. For instance, Frozen Whitefish, he's Yupik, and he's doing kind of like a folksy kind of country, but in his language. And they have certain ways that they do songs, but if you didn't know that, you wouldn't, you know, realize it.
Well, that's that kind of stuff is very exciting to hear. And I also feel like songs are at the spearhead of language initiatives. Without including songs into our language recovery programs, I think we fail. I think that we as musicians have to write songs, both in our language, songs that can be translated as well. And we need programming. You know, we need new songs also, you know, songs that are out there. And songs have a very, very gentle way of teaching language, because people can act musician the sound of a song and not feel threatened in a sense. Or they can come rewind it and say, what does that word mean, or whatever. But so I've always felt like music has been there, and it should be at the center, in the dynamic center of language acquisition and recovery. And it's kind of reflective in the native songwriting that you see out there. And that's good to hear that, what'd you call them, Frozen Fish, or what was the name of the band?
Frozen Whitefish.
Yeah.
There's also another artist, her name is Allison Warden, and or Aku Matu, and she speaks in her language, which if you look on the actual word that it is written out, there is no way in the world I'm thinking that I can pronounce this word. I'm just like, seriously, I don't know how to say that. But she uses beats to and the rhythms of it, to phonetically use her language to where I know I can say that word because of the way she does it. And she's teaching the kids that, and it was very impressive. And I thought, see, look at this is another form of getting the youth involved in the language and showing them, look, it's not that hard. Just, you know, she was using music for them to be able to pronounce these words.
And that's the thing, too. I think people think, like, when we're talking about song and language acquisition, we're not saying we're going to make you fluent by learning the song. It's one piece of the spoke, the beautiful piece of the spoke, that is part of this whole movement. And if we can just teach our own people how to say the word for God in our language, you know, like for Anishinaabe, Gichimanidu. There's so much self-empowerment just in being able to say that in your own language, to address our Creator in our languages, in our individuals, that that this is what we're about anyways, about our radio, about our programs. This is what I hear in all of you, your programs. This is why I was excited to come on tonight, because I've heard your work, each of you's in your radio work, and I think that's the salt of the earth that I'm hearing. That's the real movement, and it's pretty critical that we continue this. And also, you know, encourage our people to get out there and write songs, man. We need new programming.
Yes.
Can I tell a story about something I learned from Keith? Okay, now we're talking about learning.
Okay.
I think we were in Milwaukee. It was at the Indian Summer Fest. It was a combination of that plus the Native American Music Awards. This was some years ago. And Keith had a rental car, you know, and I guess we were going to dinner or something like that. We were kind of parked in this backstage area. And, you know, it's a huge expanse of parking around this outdoor amphitheater thing, but there was a special parking area, and we went to dinner, I guess, in a bunch of cars, and there was Blackfire was there. I think we had about seven people in this little sedan, you know, and we went off to dinner or something, and when we came back, you know, the show was about to start, and the place was packed, and forget about the backstage parking, it was totally packed. And Keith just, you know, drives on in, and there's the parking attendant in an orange vest with one spot with an orange cone in it, and waves Keith in, and whoop, in we went. And was like, Keith, how did you do that? And he's like, always tip the parking attendant. he had tipped her on the way out. So he's one of the basic radio skills that I now carry with me, thanks to Keith Sekola.
Yeah.
Get to know. That's how
you
get the
good that you live so long that you learn from yourself.
That's an important lesson, though.
Well, one of the other...
We talked about using music and whatnot to help with language acquisition. Music and humor go a long way towards bringing ideas that people may not be comfortable with to a state where they're not looking quite as askance at them. You know, whatever it can be. It can be politics, it can be all sorts of issues. With music and humor, you can say things that you couldn't just get up on stage and say, too.
I want to address that. I just personally talked exactly about that exact subject. You know, they do TEDx events all over the world, and they did one here in Anchorage, and my subject was music is life, storytelling songs, and I basically said, as a host and producer of Earth Song, it's my great opportunity to showcase not only these artists' music, but also these artists who are talking about issues that are facing them in you know, indigenous communities all over the world. And I was speaking to that exact subject of, think of a time where you've maybe been in a situation or somebody you know is in a situation that's talking about domestic violence, suicide, abuse, substance abuse, you know, any of these major subjects that are very hard for people to deal with. And think about somebody saying, well, you shouldn't do that, and this is how you take care of, you know, getting out of that situation. And people, they don't want to hear it. They don't want you to preach to you, or they don't want to hear you preaching to them. They just don't want to hear it because they're feeling guilt aspect. But yet, at the same time, you can have a song that talks about these very harsh issues, and it's that person's own priority and prerogative to take the time to listen to the song, and it's their decision to decide that they're, you know, going to listen to the message of that song, they're going to connect to the message of this song, and maybe, you know, they start healing from that, or they look at themselves and their situation because of that song, and it really moved them to think about doing something different about their situation. But yet, if you preach to that person about the same subject, they may not want to listen to you. They're not having it. But yet, that's the power of music, is that, you know, not only can we talk about serious subjects, but if you think about any time period within, you know, the last, you know, like the 1940s, 50s, or whatever, just bring up all the music, and they'll tell you what happened in that period of time, what injustices happened during that time, because they're basically telling their stories about what is happening in to them currently in present time in their situation. I had watched this documentary, and there was this documentary of people in Africa. They use the word ngoma, which means songs, and it was their way to tell about the injustices that were happening to them because nobody was listening to them speaking, but they were basically trying to heal from what was happening to them through the music that they brought out, and they are also trying to tell the rest of the world, hey, look, this is what's happening here. You're not listening to us, but are you going to listen to our music? And a lot of the time, you know, that sometimes will bring things to the forefront. So I think that music is a healing in all different aspects when it comes to hard subjects or love or, you know, whatever it may be.
It's like the spoonful of sugar that makes the medicine go down, you know?
Yeah.
And it really does. It makes it much easier, and humor does the same thing. Yeah, we don't have anybody on tonight that deals with humor, but are there Native American comedians?
We do.
Yeah, there's a lot of Native American comedians. One of the first ones who's a friend to a lot of us, Sully Hill, who's been kind of the pioneer and, you know, has been around. And I remember Charlie would tell me about when he was on the Richard Pryor show. And right before he went on, Richard Pryor comes over to him and he goes, "You better be funny, Indian." And that's what he told him, right? Right before he went on the air. And, you know, like, he's been around a long time, but the same thing, you know, how do you get to subjects? And comedians have, they got much more range. They can just tear something up directly, or they can shred it to pieces through metaphors. But still, you know, very vital. And I know that there's a whole new slug of younger Indian comedians going around, but I think that when you talk about Native humor and Native comedians, Charlie would come up, and I'm sure that some of the other people have some comments.
And Drew LaCapa, another one that I do as well.
He's the fry bread king, yes.
well, Keith, I was just thinking about your comment about metaphors, and it sort of gets back to the regionalism or the tribalism, I guess, is a little bit closer to home. That there's a lot being said, in whatever form it is, whether it's a traditional song or contemporary blues or jazz. There's a lot being said that you have to be from that part of the country to really understand what is being said and how it's being viewed. So, you know, that may get back to the regionalism and how close people stay to home.
I think it's also close to, you know, when, David, it's also very close to understanding oppression, you know, when we can understand the view from those oppressed. And that's the only place it's going to come from. You know, like when we talk about injustice, why not start with Native Americans? You know, why not start with First Americans, you know, Inuits, First People, and let their story be told without us trying to interpret it or trying to add, you know, well, is it really that way, or saying like we understand, but just understand
you know, oppression by understanding our music, because a lot of our writers come from the state of where we're from, the people, we're from where the songs are from, because we're in the village being attacked, you know, so we kind of know, and I don't, and once again, it's metaphors, I don't mean like the cavalry's attacking us, I could mean diabetes is circling our village and attacking us too.
Yeah.
And so all these things, and so, you know, I can see that regionalism leads to understanding.
You know, with all the regionalism and the tribalism and so forth and so on, you know, part of what we're seeing is that mainstream America and Native America need to get to know each other in a much more positive way, because understanding each other will make things much more diverse, much more realistic for everybody. And part of it is, nobody really, you know, unless they're Native American, they don't have a realistic view of Native America. It's not like we can turn on the TV and see a reality program of what it's really like.
I agree, and, there's BET, there's, you know, Latin television, but where's our, you know, we don't have, you know, something that's streaming like that. I mean, NAPT, you can... documentaries, videos, and stuff like that, but where's our own native channel? So, you know, that's the other thing. It's like, well, if we can ever even get there, I think that's maybe somewhat a first step to get towards mainstream.
And for every person that's part of Native America proper today, there is probably 25 people that have Native American ancestors, or maybe more than that. You know, I'm taking kind of a wild guess here. So there's lots of people who have Native American ancestors, and until they can reconcile that part of their own history with who they are today, how can we expect this nation to do the same thing? And that's only going to be achieved with understanding. You know, you really need to understand.
Yeah, and how we build that, you know, there has to be this economic ladder that builds it up. I mean, if you look at, you know, Korean television or... Spanish language television or BET or any of the others. I mean, some have a national network in another country to rely upon for programming, but others have just built up an economic base here in this country to support that kind of specialized niche programming on television and move it closer to the mainstream. A lot of people, you know, in this business will say, wow, Native Radio, you guys must have a lot of money from the casinos and stuff. But just the opposite is true. I mean, yeah, they have advertising budgets, but they know who their clients are. It's
well, talking about
what generalize, but you know what I mean? It's like there's a certain kind of audience out there for gambling that they can get on a local AM station or something like that, and they're not really yet that interested in supporting a Native radio national platform upon which
hang
we could
on to those thoughts, Rick. It's time for us to go to a break. So,
okay.
Folks, stay tuned. We will be back in just a couple of minutes with more from Cheyenne, Greg, and David.
high strings of UFO, paranormal, occult, metaphysics, and politics. We always march into the apocalypse every Saturday at 11 p.m. Eastern. The Church of Faith.com, Paranormal Radio Network.org. J-Con is watching.
Light up your night with the Kevin Smith Show. Hi, this is Kevin Smith. Join me Monday through Friday right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Tune in to UFO Undercover, Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern, with your host, Joe Montaldo, right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Welcome back to the Dawn of Shades. I'm Gia Scott. Tonight I am joined by my co-host, Keith Cicola, and we are having a fantastic conversation with Greg McVicker, David Sam, and Cheyenne Beatty. David, you were bringing up some stuff that was going on about language in Alaska. You want to tell the audience a little bit about it, too?
Well, just recently, a bill has passed, and I think they're doing some fine-tuning on it, to send to the governor of the state of Alaska, and it's called the Alaska Native Language Council. And there's a lot of pretty familiar voices from a lot of different tribes up here in attendance at a meeting. And they were discussing the issue of language, Alaska Native language, indigenous language here in the state of Alaska. And some of the comments were reflecting on what it means to a young person in their development that students did a lot better in the predominantly English-speaking schools when they knew or were exposed to their language at a very young age, and how much that meant that they did better at the English-speaking school in understanding a lot of the different concepts. But it's pretty fascinating to think about this. Our radio station is based in Anchorage, Alaska, which is about, 200 and some thousand?
Yeah, about 250,000 people in this area.
Yeah, which is about half the state population, and we cover a pretty huge area. Alaska is the largest state in the U.S., covering a large area, and we have six or seven major linguistic groups up here. And within each of them, they have many different dialects, and a lot of folks can tell where you're from by the way you speak. But the issue being that getting back to a lot of songs being done in their traditional language, that it makes much more sense on a local level in the when it's written and thought of in their own language first before they translate it into English. And it's a lot harder translating from English, writing a song, translating it back into a particular language. So it just leads for a lot of thought, I guess, is what I'm saying, that when you think about how language is used and understood, music attaches a lot. I was just thinking of, I can't even remember, Cree, Art Napoleon. who's done a lot of contemporary songs in the Cree language. But when you listen to the song, you recognize the tune, and you know the English words to it. But it sounds so much so different than in the Cree language.
Uh-huh. Anybody else have anything to add to that?
Well, I was thinking like language. Also, like when you talk about the acquisition in dialects, I know like there's a movement in Anishinaabe country because of all the dialects in Canada and in Minnesota, in Michigan, Ontario, that it's more or less, let's learn the language and then we'll worry about the dialects, which is kind of contrary to what we're saying, that we learn it regionally and things like that. But now there's a broader perspective of like let's teach a song. But also as a writer of songs, you know, like when we're writing our language, it's also how we interpret it as where we are in 2012. I'm not trying to think about, like, if I want to say a word, I'm trying to think of what that word could mean, like what it implies musically, instead of trying to maybe interpret it with the exact interpretation of the language into English, but more or less concerned with musical interpretation, like as far as specifics, when we write, you know, and we take liberty as a writer and as an interpreter of our language where we're at in 2:12, because sometimes I think we can get bogged down with too many words and trying to explain these regional dialectal things that sometimes it is for specific regions, and it does identify if you're singing a sing-song, a version of Anishinaabe, or more of a linear speaking version of it, in different parts you can tell, and as a writer, you know, like, where is our interpretation? And that's what we're trying to do, is interpret where we are. So often native artists try to remember so much about who we were as we forget who we are. And I think this getting off point of where we're at right now is a more honest indication that will lead to a better understanding of who we were as well.
Yeah, language
is sometimes an important thing
dynamic
to remember who we are today. Go ahead, Greg.
Yeah, language is dynamic, you know, that's what the linguist's always saying. It's constantly changing, and, you know, today's artists are a big part of that.
When you guys, if I could ask a question, oftentimes I think, you know, of Native, where we are as Native and First Nations people, and I think that they tried to destroy us with poverty. I think if they tried to use wealth, they would have did a better job. I really do. I think if we were wealthy, we would lose everything. So what is that? Is that a subject out there?
when you look at American culture in general,
I mean, we'd be pretty greedy, pretty individuals.
Yeah. Identity of any kind tend to be poverty-stricken.
Uh-huh.
Those who become much more mainstream tend to be more affluent. That's very true. If you wanted the Native American culture completely, flood them with money.
Yeah, I know. And we laugh about it. I mean, because we're kind of realize, you know, I got a sticker that says Indian Power, and I stuck it on my bumper. That's what holds my car together. We laugh about this deprived economic situation we're in. But you see what wealth does to people, how greedy it makes people. You see what a little bit of wealth does to our own people, how we discount our relatives, how we kind of like, well, we'll base this on quantum, you know, blood quantum or whatever it is. But sometimes I think like that. I think like, well, maybe they should have just made us wealthy. They would have got rid of Indians a lot, you know, language and a lot of other aspects if we had nothing to worry about.
That's,
yeah, you know, similarly, you always kind of take a different tack on that. You know, Sherman Alexie makes some interesting points about that, the writer, you know, that the best thing people can do is get off the res, you know, and I'm not really quoting him here exactly, but kind of get more into the middle class and succeed that way. And you see a lot of people that have been deprived for so long, when they finally get something, they don't really, you know what to do with it. I mean, how many new black pickup trucks can you roll, you know, before you realize, man, I shouldn't take this money and buy a new pickup truck. I don't know. Big topic.
Yeah, well, you know, I don't know for Native American, by leaving their communities, is it harder for them to stay connected to their culture? Because culture, language, community, they kind of all go together.
I would say in the native community, I think we have more access to it because our relatives are there on the reservation in the sense of coming back. If you know, I would just think that we'd have more access to who we were because we're still around.
That's
well,
true.
I know that
I'd
for
love
you,
to have that
the Mississippi
here
now,
in the San Francisco
no,
Bay Area.
Extended there's family. Go ahead.
I stepped on you. I'm sorry. I would agree with Keith, but also add that there are some very vibrant intertribal communities that have, you know, sprung up in cities around the country, cities that were spots where the BIA, you know, sent people, usually with some kind of a ruse like, oh, there'd be good jobs or whatever, there's relocations. But Oakland, California is one of those, and a lot of Native people in Oakland, from all different tribes. I mean, that's why the Alcatraz thing happened here. There's a program at KPFA, the original listener-sponsored radiostation.org, that I've been involved with for a long time and helping out starting a show called Bay Native Circle. And it's a weekly talking circle kind of thing where everybody comes in and, you know, everybody as anybody comes through those doors and talks about what they're up to. So, you know, you can have community in urban areas, but it's got a whole different flavor to it, intertribal, which kind of has its own protocols and feel to it that borrow from, you know, the hundreds of different tribal traditions that are out there.
Oh, I think too, like what you're describing, Greg, is this cultural island in the middle of suburbia, and it's true. I mean, it's really a tribute to how plural and dynamic our people are in their interpretation and their adaptation to who we are. And you'll find these cultural islands and sanctuaries in different parts of America. But Oakland is really interesting because of the Friendship House and the whole, you know, movement with the American Indian movement. And a lot of social things came to a head there in the 60s. And it is interesting what happened up there, and there is a real vibrant community that is a plural community that we don't really get involved in the definition so much, but just accepting the plate that we're all given right now. And so I can see what you're talking about, Greg, and also I'm sure, like, you know, in Alaska where Cheyenne and David are, I'm not, you know, like, I'm sure that Anchorage has its own Indian jungles or its Indian hangouts and things like that as well, and then probably creates this dynamicness of suburban versus village living and vice versa.
Yeah, but I would also add, Keith, that a lot of the people that, you know, listen in to this show I was talking about or come to our Tlingit Haida village celebrations and so on. They come in from all kinds of suburbs from around Northern California. I mean, people are living in a lot of different places for reasons, but they do, you know, seize these opportunities to come together whenever they can.
And how about, you know, today with the online communities, you know, is that a part of who Native America is today?
Definitely.
I think we've adapted online.
The internet a lot to connect with my family because, you know, like I said, I've relocated to Mississippi. I don't have extended family here. I am fortunate enough that my daughter moved here and now my granddaughter also lives here. So I have, you know, that much family here, besides myself and my husband. But outside of that, all of my family is someplace else. And so that, you know, that creates sort of a cultural dilemma for me, because your innermost culture is always your family and extended family. And I'm sure that's true with Native America as well as everybody else.
Just to circle back to radio for a second. Yeah, to circle back to radio on the same topic. I mean, it's interesting that I would quite regularly hear from students, you know, at UC Berkeley or at Stanford or different campuses around that could hear Earth songs back when I was doing that, and they would say, hey, it makes me feel like I'm back home, you know. So, and maybe you've had that same experience, but wherever people are, they're in the armed services, they're in college, they're away on some kind of job site, if they do have a connection to Native radio, either through a local affiliate or through streaming, it makes it feel like they're back home with their people.
I think you're right, and you know what, I think we lost Cheyenne, too. Gee, is there any way we can reconnect her or something like that?
Yeah, we're gonna go back to a break, and we will get Cheyenne back on the radio. I think we lost David too.
Yeah,
no, I'm still here. I'm still here.
You're still here. Okay.
We thought maybe Alaska's falling into the ocean.
You too. Yeah, you know, it was funny just before this program there was a rerun playing, and they were having trouble trying to get a guest in Alaska. And I thought, oh, I hope this isn't an omen. But, folks, we are going to take a real quick break here, and we will be back with you in just a minute. Maybe.
Greg,
yeah. But you're right, Gia. The time is flying, and we're all having a hard time getting moving edgewise here. I have 2 hours. Are you kidding me?
No, it goes by incredibly quickly. And I don't know.
Yeah. Looking forward to getting a new album, Keith.
Yeah, yeah. For sure I'm going to find this one and get it out there, because I really poured my heart into it. In fact, this morning, I was just at the last 3 days I was been at the studio. It's like, oh, I got 16 songs on it. Maybe I got one more, you know. Kind of like.
We're still live and on the air, guys. I guess the producer dropped the ball there for a second.
So did we lose his Cheyenne available with us or no?
Yeah, we're going to go to break and then we will get Cheyenne back.
The low rider is a little take a little trip to Z. Take a little trip, take a little trip, take a little trip with me.
Welcome back to the Donna Shades. I'm your host, G.S. Scott, and we're continuing right along with my co-host, Keith Sokola, David Sam, Greg McVicker, and Cheyenne Beattie. We've got Cheyenne back again now. I sort of lost my train of thought. I know that when we were off on break, Keith was talking about his new album, and I'm really looking forward to hearing it come out, too. And hopefully everybody else will be as
well, I think,
to hear it, too.
I think, dear, what's a good thing was how we discovered Cheyenne was off the air. She texted me and said that she got dropped. And so is there any indication that Native people are very dynamic in picking up this whole new social media and social networking? I think it's really good for Native people. And, you know, pardon our expression down here in America, we're so used to saying Native people, you know, American Indians or First Nations people, I guess is the right term.
You know, I was thinking about
what is the right term, really? You know,
I think you can come down to tribalism.
People.
It's the tribalisms, I think, you know, like what, I did a music festival in Miami Beach and, Chaka Khan was playing. And I was there on the sound, listening to her, the monitor section, and she had a break in the music, and when she came over there, she seen me, and she goes, hey, brother, you know, how are you doing? You know, and she says, she introduced herself as having Native blood as well. And then she went on to say, I got in trouble a few years ago with the Native media. I referred to the woman as squaw. And she says, what's the right word, Keith? You know, what's the right word? And it's almost like, what is the word for Native American? You know, I said, well, it kind of comes down to tribalisms. You know, like ask yourself in your tribe, if you're whatever your tribe is, what is the right word for woman? So I just gave her the right word in Anishinaabe, which is Ikwe. And it would probably be the same thing, you know, like really what is a proper term? But there's so many different languages and different things. I would say Anishinaabe would be the way to call somebody if they were Indian. Are you Anishinaabe? Gida Anishinaabe, you'd ask them. And I think that would probably be more of a correct numer than saying Native American or are you Indian or are you, you know, of course Eskimo was the S word up there for a long time.
Yeah, it's definitely different for us because, you know, we wouldn't be considered Native American necessarily. We're Alaska Native. And for a long time, everybody just was referred to as Eskimo in Alaska, which there is, it's totally, there's so many different cultures within the state of Alaska. You know, there's the Indians and the Eskimos, but now we have all these different cultures that now it's Aleutic, Supiak, Tlingit Haida, Tsimshian, Eyak, St. Lawrence Island, Yupikins, Athabascans. There's 11 different Athabascan groups as well as the Yupik and the Chupik. So I think more and more people are not going into general terms anymore. We are definitely identifying ourselves very specifically from where we are from.
Well, that makes absolute sense. I mean, because that's really your cultural identity. just like saying, well, I'm an American, it really doesn't say much about me culturally because, you know, we're a pretty diverse nation, actually. You know, we may try to present ourselves as this homogenized mixture, but we're really a whole lot more like a stew. We've never been pureed all that well. And there's nothing wrong with stew, you know? It's interesting.
Because yeah, I think now more than ever, though, it's very important for us to identify ourselves very specifically because this is the day and the age that we are trying to bring back our culture, bring back our languages, and, you know, there's, before it was just, I'm Aleut. Well, now it's not. It's Aleutic Subject, Unangan, Unangak. And it's where these people are from, and their languages are different. Even for us as Athabascans, my husband is Dena'ina Athabascan, but his language in Athabascan is nowhere similar as the Hongwatin Athabascans. And so it's very important, I think, especially now that we are very much trying to revitalize our languages and our cultures. We are that specific, and it's hard for people, I think, in general, not to be able to say a greeting to you in your specific culture because not very many people know that because it's not a well-known advertised thing. And even with us in Alaska, being Alaska Natives, I just learned within the last 10 years the difference of all Alaska Native cultures. I, too, was to blame as an Alaska Native thinking Eskimo and Indian, but it is a lot more specific than that, and I didn't know about it until I was educated upon it.
Uh-huh. As a DJ, I always find it's a challenge to properly identify artists and where they're from, give listeners, you know, kind of a cultural snapshot. And just like I wouldn't say, well, that's African artist, you know, whatever, I would say, well, here's an artist from Kenya or Nigeria or Sudan or Mali. You know what I mean? You at least want to narrow it down a little bit. I'm sure there are clans and tribes and so on within those areas. But in the U.S., I always try to make an effort to figure out what, you know, I don't just say, oh, Native artist Bill Miller. And we say, well, you know, from Stockbridge, Muncie, Mohican, that's Bill Miller, you know. And try and narrow it down for folks. And I think it helps everyone better
understand.
Well, I think
that's important. I heard that I had trouble even pronouncing the names. I mean, especially where I've never seen them written before. And, you know, I'm like, I don't know how to say that word. I mean, you know, to me, it's, you know, an alien association. I don't know what it sounds like. How am I going to say this?
It's hard.
Well, that's the thing about it is, like, when I do my show, I let the person introduce themselves and say where they're from.
Well, you noticed that I kind of
give them that opportunity.
Right.
Yeah, that's good.
And it's because, you know, after seven weeks with Keith, I can now say Mishinagwa. Okay, it took 7 weeks.
Well, you know what? I think, too, when you're getting at it, like, there's a bill that protects American Indian artists, you know, that would say we want authentic American Indian artists. And I think by implying, you know, well, tell us who you are. You know, I can't just say I'm a Cherokee. From where? You know, like, well, those are good questions, you know, because if we should be able to, and it ain't the exception. I mean, maybe somebody, because of history, I can understand not understanding where we're from. But I think if you ask a Native artist, you know, where they're from, they'll gladly specific with you, even tell you their clan if they have one, you know, or they're aware of them and things like that, which
I think
it does protect us.
A lot of people, I mean, for us here, it's not, and it's just not like, hi, I'm Cheyenne Beanie, I'm Hongwatin Athabascan. When Alaska Native people introduce themselves up here, it's like, hi, I'm Cheyenne Beanie, I'm Hongwatin Athabascan. My mother is from Eagle, Alaska. My grandparents are the June Bees from Eagle, Alaska, who are Hongwatin. My father is from this side, from Minto, or, you know, it's basically, you know, very more elaborate. We tell our backstory, our family stories.
and who we're related
you know, like in
and
the,
what our family names are.
The Diné, the Navajo down here, when they have their beauty contest, that's one of the things they're judged on, you know, like their family histories, like how well they know them, their clans and things like that. But I was just getting at the point where it is important that we protect our native musicians. And, you know, that not everybody can just claim it. I mean, it's easy to claim it. It's like a seasoning or something like that, you know, or they want native music on their records, so they'll sprinkle a little bit of salt and pepper, little powwow song at the beginning and then little powwow song at the end of it. And, here's a cultural song, you know, and hooray, hooray, you know, so that was my point.
I wanted to bring up
while
we have a
little
time.
About, Cheyenne. Go ahead, Greg.
Yeah, our international listeners, you know, we do have listeners to the individual radio stations, to NV1. I know that we get hits at undercurrentsradio.net, people listening in places like Belgium and Japan, and we have a new station in New Zealand. And I just think it's really an exciting opportunity for us to bring authentic Native voices and authentic culture, even though it's kind of, you know, squeezed down into the radio format, to bring this, you know, contemporary, real piece of Native culture and put it out there for everyone to experience around the world. Because those of you that, you know, traveled around probably have noticed there's either no understanding whatsoever of American Native culture or a highly, highly distorted version. You know, you'll see some guys doing in flute music dressed as Apache warriors with war paint and all this stuff, and it's like, what? You know?
Yeah.
You know, and in Germany, there's this deep fascination, I'm told, with Native cultures and, you know, there's vendors that sell beads and everything. In fact, here, I'm told, because of the intertribal movement, there's a lot of sort of intermingling, you know, and there's a lot of intermarriage, of course, but there's just a general sort of intermingling of patterns and, you know, traditional weavings and things like that that would normally be very specific to a very specific place. That still lives on in Germany because people have become fanatically obsessed with, you know, recreating an 1800s weaving pattern or whatever from a certain clan, you know.
Well, you know, I'd see that ramification when we would tour Europe. You know, I had a record deal in the 90s, and we went out there with some pretty heavy American bands, you know, bands like Nirvana, bands like that, that were cutting undergrounds, an American Indian band. And we went out there and we would tour, and a lot of times I'd bring a dancer who would be a singer on a powwow or something. And some people would get stuck on that, you know, like they would think that that was it, you know, like that was the real Indian, American Indian. They wouldn't see the dynamic that we're here today and we're here right in front of you right now. And they'd almost freeze us in the ethnocentric music past and have a harder time accepting. And, you know, it also comes to my other point of, you know, pictures and things that would picture us in our traditional garb from hundreds of years ago, and they wouldn't put pictures of us in our dynamic here we are in today because of the whole myth that we made Indians extinct, that manifest destiny work, the doctrines of discovery. They were pertinent. And so you see a lot of that, you know, in that acceptance of who we are as electric warriors or as our things. And you know, we wouldn't want an Indian face so much and put on our Indian costumes just so we get accepted by, you know, the entertaining audience.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think those are prime examples of why people are very uneducated about Native Americans, Alaska Natives in general, is they've been seeing the Hollywood versions of Alaska Natives and Native Americans, and yet we're not in the mainstream, so they don't know any better to understand the differences between us, and that, no, we don't, I mean, yes, we put on our regalia, and we also celebrate our cultures, but at the same time, we don't live our lives like that day to day anymore, and it's funny to think that people in the 21st century still have that mindset, but where do they go in mainstream media to find out that that's not true?
Well, you know, even if you looked at mainstream media on the Billboard shows, Nelly Furtado had Tony Duncan, a championship hoop dancer, dance live on national TV the other night. And it was like, wow, she finally discovered, or like, you know, mainstream is discovering us after we've been dancing with hoop dancers for 30 years, you know. And her interpretation and understanding is like, musically, it doesn't sync up, and you know, it's just, well, I'm glad that she did that. And Tony's a brilliant young man, and you know, at least I'm glad to see a little misappropriation rather than none. You know.
Well, I was talking earlier about the visibility, or even the auditory response you get when you hear someone that is indigenous to the Americas speaking. We don't have that luxury of having on CBS News or ABC News or any of the major stream news networks of seeing obviously Native American people. You just don't see them. We don't have that luxury. There was a lot of discussion earlier about the music and the regionalism, the tribalism, and sadly, there's not too many Native-owned stations, really, or we don't have the luxury of having tribal members that are completely the decision-makers in radio.
You know, I think a lot of that might
that
be
all
as a result
too,
of the
like
lack
it.
Of political pressure. You know, thinking back on the 60s and the 70s when there were no black anchors, there were no women anchors on television, it was rather intense pressure from the civil rights movement, from you know, black power, all aspects of the African-American cultural, you know, uprising, awakening, whatever you want to call it. Same with women, the women's movement really pushed through those kinds of changes. And there was an uprising or a cultural renaissance, whatever you want to call it, in, you know, the early 70s with American Indian culture. But I don't think it ever got to the point where people like demanded that the TV stations hire anchors that were Native. And had they would be around, you know.
So we should start doing that right now, Greg?
I'm sorry?
Interesting.
So we should start demanding that right now, then?
Yeah, let's get our picket signs out, man, and just head.
Well, it would be nice to see that, and I think that transformation is the most powerful tool that we have individually, and that transformation is what we're seeing in our era, and it's happening before our very eyes. Even on this radio station, we're doing this interview with Gia. She decided it's time to run 8 episodes of Native America on her talk show, and I think it's an indication that we're seeing the transformation, and we're living and breathing it, and we're part of this wonderful transformation that we're seeing. We are becoming the change agent. We are becoming the change agents, the agents for change. And it's all part of who we are as our makeup today. You know, this is what we're ushering in. We're seeing, you know, that demand, that thing. It's just, it takes so long that it's hard sometimes to comprehend the consciousness of time, how long it takes to critically criticize this so people see that Indian mascots are ridiculous.
Yeah.
Well, I also think now it's one of those things where being Native American, Alaska Native, is prideful and cool to be, but yet it wasn't, say, 20 years ago or 30 years ago, so nobody even wanted to acknowledge that they were Alaska Native or Native American. But now there's this huge surgence of that everybody, you know, is more, I guess, wanting to hear from Native AmeriCorps or seeking to hear from Native Americans and Alaska Natives. And so now some of the things that I have a problem with at times is people who are claiming that they're Native American because they have been, what is it, asked to be in a tribe or adopted into a tribe.
Yeah, that's another weird thing there, and I think as Native people, we just hate to be so judgmental as far as clamping down the enrollment force or whatever it is that would determine you. Just hope like these people weed themselves out, you know. It's like, you know, I don't know. I know that dilemma.
That in our music, the music that people send to me, like, for instance, I've been getting emails from, I believe it's like Big City Indians. I don't think any of them are Native American.
They're from Vienna. They're from, like, Europe and everything like that. Yeah,
Germany, I understand.
But this is the type of submissions that I am getting for my Earth Song show. And, you know, people are saying that they're Alaska Native or Native American, and they're not.
It's just so hard to be able to, you know, to understand that complexity of it, too, because on one hand, you know that this quantum system is messed up identifying tribal enrollment. You know that. It's just we concentrate way too long on quantum and not enough about citizenship or even our traditional methods of how we identify each other through the matriarchal lineage in Anishinaabe. That we kind of like, but my point was before I brought it up was that we don't have no national organization that protects us like American Indian Art with, you know, like it'd have degrees. Is it American Indian handicrafted? Is it all made from Indian, you know, kind of things like that. And, you could see that more and more, you know, as far as, I don't know why people would claim it if they weren't, but I see it. So, I mean, it ain't so hard for me to understand that.
And even when I was setting up this program, one of the questions I would ask people was, are you Native American? And it seemed like such a weird question, but I wanted to make sure, because of the whole focus of the program, was that it's first-hand voices. You know, to be adopted wasn't enough. You had to, you know, in order to really know what you're talking about, you kind of have to live the life. And that means you kind of had to be Native American. It'd be, you know, like me trying to tell somebody what it's like to be a man. I don't have a clue. I'm not a man. I've watched men my whole life, but, you know, I don't know.
Well, what's fascinating about this, you know, I was trying to figure out now what is going to be the discussion points on this radio program. And I think we've sort of taken about an hour and a half to get to, you know, who are you? And how do you identify yourself? You know, Cheyenne was talking a little bit ago about, her background and who her parents are. And for a lot of folks, and it's getting more difficult. I was wondering about the issue of, is it okay to be Native, or is it just happened to be that, I think a lot of us here are probably over 30 years of age, you know, and what are the younger people experiencing? You know, from what I see, kind of like me when I was a teenager, at an age where it was definitely not okay, and I must say that it's probably true to even this day. Cheyenne was just mentioning to me about a Native person attending one of the local churches, Western Christian churches here, and was told that the Native church was down the street. Yeah, no natives allowed. You know, your church is around the corner or something. But at any rate,
wow.
of identifying who we are, you know, just by my saying my Thlinkit name, for a Thlinkit speaking, Thlinkit understanding person, just my name alone would tell them what my clan is, would tell them, would remind them of where the picking berry area is that we used, where our fishing area was used, where we hunted, just by a name, because it's very tied into the clan and the crests, and it's fascinating to think in terms of all these people that are being adopted, and you know, it doesn't give them any rights to that, you know. So, you know, I just really appreciated the conversation today. A lot to think about. To hear the idea of, you know, what does it mean to be Thlinkit, or the generic terms, American Indian, Alaska Native, First Nations, very generic. And regionalism and tribalism, you know, we can talk about Thlinkit people. We can talk about, okay, what's with Thlinkit people? Well, you know, we could go back into the 50-some clans that there are.
I know, even in that aspect itself, I mean, I'm Alaska Native, but yet I don't understand the different clan systems of Thlinkit. And I don't understand certain differences between Chupik and Yupik. So, I mean, even as an Alaska Native person, I don't understand all of those things. So I'm sure it will be hard for the general public to try to understand all different types of Native American, Alaska Native culture, because it's so complex.
It certainly isn't going to fit into one convenient one-size-fits-all pigeonhole.
No, definitely not.
It's
all very different.
I mean, and we
at the same time, as you talked about, you know, you can't claim your clan and a history and everything if you weren't born to it. You cannot deny it by simply saying, I'm not going to claim it. That's still part of who you are.
Mm-hmm.
And even if it's been generations since anybody really paid any attention to it or even admitted to it, it still has shaped who you are today. For all those people out there who have, you know, Native American, Alaskan Native, whatever ancestors, all those ancestors formed a piece of who you are today, and right down to the point of shaping the culture that you relate to.
Well, you
it may not be a single one, but it still shaped it. Go ahead.
You talked earlier about smiling when you heard chicken scratch, or was it Wayla? Is that what you said?
Yeah,
chicken scratch music, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you smile. It's just like, you know, I'll smile when I can smell the smoked fish that comes from smack in the middle of a village in Sitka, you know, and it kind of brings those memories back, you know.
Or the moose hide of the interior, yes, I totally agree.
So there's a lot, you know, again, you know, both of you just gave me a lot to think of, and listening to Shai and Greg, just amazing to think in terms of, you know, what is Native American media? You know, there's so much that can be done through it, and so much that we've come a long way, you know, from a small community radio station to tweeting and Facebooking each other.
And, you know, this
and a lot of people these days. A lot of people these days, I think you can find social media, social media these days, you can definitely get a lot more access to become educated about Native Americans and Alaska Natives.
Well, that was the whole point of this show, is to let people hear from the first, the people in the source. You know, three of the sources today, from regional and national, local, people who have been working in Native radio for a while and establish themselves and have followers that listen to your programs. You know, and this is one of the aspects. What can we do? How can we help Native radio by spreading a course propagation and say, listen to these programs, listen to these musicians, listen to these journalists, listen to these DJs. And that was the whole aspect of, let's try to get a grip on how we can help people more by ushering in these subjects and these topics that as Americans we've been afraid to talk about for a while. And as American Indians, as Inuit people or in First Nations people, we haven't had the platform to talk about these things for a while. And all of a sudden, we're on the turtle's back and we have a megaphone in our hands.
And you know, I had a really good experience today on Earth Songs with my interview. They said, you know, I just really want to thank you for a show like Earth Songs, because even though we're in an area that is largely an urban city, we have the opportunity to connect with other Native Americans and Alaska Natives throughout the country by listening to Earth Songs online and find out what is everybody else doing, like who's bringing new music out, what are their songs about, where are they playing, and they just were very happy that Earth Songs was one of those programs that they were able to keep in touch with other Native Americans and Alaska Natives, even though they may have not seen them for years or don't get to talk to them in person.
And it's a two-way street, you know. We hope that the rest of the nation and the rest of the world will get to know us better, but we're intensely inquisitive about other cultures as well. And there are subgroups and clans and regions everywhere in the world. You know, if you start studying the music of other nations of Africa and, you know, countries like Ireland and, you know, there's all these rich musical traditions that, you know, we borrow from too. And, you know, we're interested in you, wherever you are, and what your cultures are, and we hope that you'll be interested in ours as well.
I think that's really a good statement, Greg, because Native people are very open to the world and the things. You know, and maybe that's where they think that we think our culture is not as important, is that we value outside knowledge as well as who we are, maybe more than any other culture. Not to say that our culture is inadequate or anything, it's just that we are so inquisitive about the world in which we live in. I think I've seen that more in Native artists and Native journalism and radio and things like that, is like we're a little bit more interested in learning about other things than ourselves, especially when we come to the intertribal worlds, you know, like we want to understand someone that what Wayla music is, chicken scratch. We probably want to know what piddle music is. And they'd probably find the same kind of beat in some of the songs, even.
Mm-hmm. It's, you know, I think the more you learn, too, the more you expose your own ignorance in some ways, and then you know, you really don't know everything. You know, I think about, you know, myself at 18 versus myself now at 51. You know, at 18, I knew everything, and now I feel like I don't know anything. And yet I know so much more than I did when I was young.
Yeah, if I knew everything right now, I think I'd be rich. I'm always constantly learning.
Yeah, we're constantly learning and learning new things. And I was always told your brain's like a muscle. If you don't use it, you're going to lose it. So I figure it's time really to get my brain going, you know, and learning new things is something that we don't stop doing just because we got out of school. and learning about different cultures, different music, different, even different languages, is illuminating to the world we live in today.
If I could ask a question to each of the three, and what would help you the most as a, whatever area you're at, is you're producing, if you're a DJ, what name of something that would help you, or what could help you?
As in what? As in the submissions?
Anything,
that
Cheyenne,
I
like I'm Informer, I need a kilowatt of power or something like that.
Well, I mean, in that aspect, you know, we're grant funded, but I would say just in general, what would help me is to be able to be marketed a lot more, to be able to make sure that, you know, I want to be that person that when, such as you, Keith, you know about Ursong, but there are other people that don't, but I want people to be trained to basically, okay, I'm a Native American indigenous artist. As soon as I get my album and I want to bring it out, who am I going to go to first? I'm going to go to Ursong because they're on 87 stations and they're going to talk about my music, and I'm going to be, this is a platform for me to be able to talk about who I am as a person, what my music is about, and what my songs are about, and the importance of all that. And that's pretty much for me. I want to be that, you know, number one show that when people think about releasing an album, the first thing they think of is Earth Songs.
Well, Shannon, I think we see that transformation right now, you know, what's happening.
It's definitely happening. How about you, David? What would you like to see change?
Well, one of the issues when we're talking about getting the music out there is, if there was a better system, and Greg and Chai mentioned it earlier, but I talked with Greg a while back about, you know, can we get this charting done? You know, what is being played across Indian country? What's happening, you know, we're way up in the very northwestern part of the North American continent. You know, what's happening down there with Seminoles down in Florida? What's being aired? What's being heard? We don't have that kind of system set up. You know, there's Billboard magazine, there's a lot of different forums for musicians to get into, but we don't have that luxury in Indian country. So having that kind of system set up, that kind of infrastructure set up would be great.
Yeah, I agree.
Me too. I would take the infrastructure thing one step further too and say, you know, speaking as an independent producer, you know, basically on my own little company, tied into this Native network that, you know, we need to raise many tens of thousands of dollars a year in addition to the grants that we get, so just to stay on the air. So we're always looking for folks that want to reach our audience, that want to help us build a stronger, sustainable network, and that, who knows, maybe even want to reconcile with Native America in some way that would, you know, think of us when it comes time to their ad budget or their charity budget or whatever every year. People spend money on things. They sometimes don't think, oh, I should take a slice and, you know, invest in Native radio. Some people do that, and we're always very thankful when they do.
Greg,
funding is a big part, I think, for us. I mean, that's really bottom line. If we want to get more into mainstream, if we want to educate people more, if we want them to hear our music, hear our language, if people just decided to do more funding with us, we'd be more than happy to produce programs to help you learn more about all these different cultures that are so great across Indian country.
And the ones that we have, keep them on the air and keep them strong.
And exactly. What about the new tribal radio stations? It seems like, I know, like in northern Minnesota, I know about four different tribes, one in Fond du Lac. I just got a startup radio station. One in the one in Red Lake wants to get a startup. One in Net Lake, and I mean these guys are. I've been to some of their radio stations, and a lot of their equipment is still in boxes. You know,
I know that's
hard to get engineers. it's hard to get engineers to put these things together. There's only a few in the country, and they go from one to the next, you know. There was kind of a wave of new native licenses that were issued recently, and this has to do with the way the FCC makes these available sort of in batches. There's a competition. So suddenly there were dozens and dozens of new stations coming on the air, but there's still only a few engineers to put them together. So,
well, I know that really on a tribal level, your programs are like their lifeblood, you know, like the Eros and the Earth Songs and all the other things that you have been behind. Man, it ain't much that a DJ has to work with, you know. And so they're looking at generating programs and songs and everything like that.
And guys, guess what? We have not only run out of time, we have run over. So before we close, you want to each give your website? We'll start off with Keith, and then we'll go
okay.
to Diane.
Mine is easysecola.com and secola.com. That's my
okay.
Website.
You're next.
My national show is earthsongs.net, and my local show is KNBA.org.
Okay, and David, do you have one also?
It's the same as Shai's with KNBA.org.
Okay, and Greg?
Undercurrentsradio.net.
Okay. Well, folks, I hope you have enjoyed this program every bit as much as I have enjoyed the program, and that it's given you all plenty of food for thought as well as more illumination for your personal journey towards truth. Join us again next week as we continue our Native American Voices series and hear another voice with another story to share with us all. It's sure to be another program that is just as thought-provoking. You've been listening to The Dawn of Shades, and I'm Gia Scott, and good night.
Hey, everybody, this is really fun.
Yeah, thank you.
Oh.